court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We call for hearing 01-0843 State versus Anulu. Representing the defendant is Mr. Hennick. Representing the state, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Hennick.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Anulu on this appeal. The central issue before the Court, or at least the primary issue on which the Court granted review, concerns whether this Court should overrule its interpretation of Section 97406, sub 4 of the Wisconsin statutes in State v. Escalon and Araño. Essentially, that comes down to how that statute should be construed, whether it should be construed as barring a defendant from raising for the first time on a 97406 petition an issue which he could have raised on direct appeal, or does it mean what this Court had said in Bergenthal, which is that you are only barred if you raised it in a prior 97406 petition. For the reasons stated in the briefs, the answer is yes, this Court should overrule Escalon and Araño. As explained in the briefs, the decision is inconsistent with the language, intent, and original purpose of 97406 sub 4. Perhaps even more importantly, it has not and cannot have its desired effect of finality. And third, it merely has created unnecessary confusion, complexity in post-conviction procedure, and a lot of extra work for the courts and for litigators.
Now, let me just ask you about that statement. What's been the extra work that you're talking about?
The extra work I'm talking about is when a Escalon and Araño has forced defendants, instead of merely asserting the merits of their claims on a first 97406 petition, as the concurring judge below explained, they have been forced to allege ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel as the sufficient reason. What that forces the courts to do, both the circuit court and the court of appeals, is to address first whether there is ineffectiveness of counsel, go through the entire analysis of that before really reaching the merits. Although, bottom line, when you do that kind of analysis, you still have to reach the merits. So the additional complexity is exactly what the concurring judge below explained. We have to go through all of these mental gymnastics to get where we would have been in the first place, which is a direct evaluation of the merits of the case.
Mr. Hennick, how would you control the situation where people in the prison system continue to bring up the same issue in one form or another again and again? Don't you think there ought to be some type of control for that?
Certainly.
And what would you suggest, sir?
97406 sub 4 addresses that. When an issue has been finally adjudicated, it cannot be raised again unless, of course, there is sufficient reason. For instance, if it has not been adequately presented for some reason before, that is actually what the language of 97406 sub 4 says. However, if there is no sufficient reason, if a defendant is just unhappy with the results, then you can't raise it again.
But wasn't that the original intent of the Escalano decision, to try to enforce that provision of the statutes?
That was one of the reasons, yes. But it was unnecessary to go to the extent that Escalon and Araño did in order to enforce that. The statute, I think, is clear, sub 4 is clear, that regardless whether the issue was raised on a direct appeal or on a prior 97406 petition, if that issue was fully litigated and decided against you, you cannot raise it again.
Well, what does Escalona do to change what you just said?
Escalona does not change anything on that particular issue.
Well, if you have a direct appeal under Escalona now,
yes,
and you don't raise an issue that could have been raised Can you bring a 97406?
Under Escalon and Arano, without alleging sufficient reason, no, you cannot.
Okay. So the difference is between what you want and what Escalona says, I think, is if you don't bring it on direct appeal, you can still bring it under 97406 if the issue wasn't raised on direct appeal.
Right.
But once it's raised, either direct appeal or 197046, it is finished, unless there's some extraordinary circumstance, the sufficient reason.
Exactly.
So what you're asking for is another shot, namely 97406, if you've had direct appeal.
Yes. Exactly. We are not asking that somebody be allowed to raise the same issue over and over again. We are only asking that they be allowed to raise it at one time.
But if they omitted it from direct appeal, you want to give them a shot to do that?
Yes.
Which Escalona does not do.
Correct.
So that's one, it's one more kick at the cat.
Yes.
That's what you're asking for.
Yes. And, well, one more kick at the cat without having to show sufficient reason.
Right.
And the reason for that is that the purpose, if we go back and look at the purpose of the 1966 version of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedures Act, and specifically Section 8, which ultimately became Subsection 4 of 97406, the purpose of that act, both general and specific, were to implement the permissive U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding successive collateral review. At that time, we had Fay v. Noya, we had Sanders v. United States. The commentary to Section 8 specifically refers to those two decisions, essentially the deliberate bypass rule, and says that what we are trying to accomplish with Section 8 of the Uniform Act is to provide a similar permissiveness for individuals who are alleging violation of their constitutional rights.
So the one more kick at the cat, or the Judge Steiniger referred to, you know, the one more layer on the onion. So you think that's going to address his problem? This is going to take care of what he's concerned about?
I believe it will. I believe that the one more layer of, or the layers of the onion, we're not referring to multiple, like a 97406 petition after a direct appeal. I believe, Your Honor, what he was referring to is the multiple layers of having to go through the ineffective assistance before actually getting to a direct review of the merits. And I do believe that reversing Escalon and Arano and returning 97406 sub 4 to its original meaning as expressed in Bergenthal would have that effect. Essentially, the Court is presented with three options today. One is to continue with Escalon and Arano with the negative effects that Judge Steiniger refers to, with the complexity and the confusion among litigants, most of whom are going to be pro se and not be able to overcome those. That's one option. Second option is that presented by the State, which is essentially to take everything that would have been a 97406 petition and throw it into the Court of Appeals, which I submit is neither supported by the language of the statute nor the history of the statute, and in fact is going to make all of the problems that the concurring judge below referred to, it's going to increase those manyfold. Instead of having issues, factual issues in the court from which the conviction came, deciding these matters, it's going to go to the Court of Appeals, which already is overworked, and resulting in habeas petitions, which is exactly the reason that 9746.
I wanted to ask about that. You talked about the overworked appellate court. Do you think that by changing this, that it's not going to cause substantially more work for the court, as there will be if you go back to the old rule? You think that there's not going to be additional cases coming up as a result of our overturning or reversing Escalon?
What there will be, in my belief, is perhaps additional cases with the individuals who did not have the ability to retain counsel or the wherewithal themselves to get through the procedural hurdles created by Escalon and Araño. They will now be able to bring their issues and have them decided on the merits.
And do you have any idea, is that going to be, is that a dozen cases or is it a couple hundred? What are you looking at?
I have no idea, Your Honor. On the other hand,
it would seem to me just from logic would say, well, if we overturn that there would be a substantial number of people, pro se or otherwise, that would be coming up with, another kick at the cat, so to speak.
Well, what we have under Escalon and Araño is a large number of individuals who are raising those issues anyway, but are raising them in the more complex and time-consuming method of having to first go through ineffectiveness of post-conviction and appellate counsel. I would refer the Court back to the history of the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedures Act, in which the Court specifically referred to the kind of concern that you are speaking about, which is an explosion trying to save court time, trying to preserve judicial economy. And in the notes, the commissioners refer to the basic principle of that act, or a basic principle of that act, which is that it is preferable to deal with claims on their merits rather than to seek an elaborate set of technical procedures to avoid considering claims that we may assume not to be meritorious. It is believed by the commissioners that it will be less burdensome to the courts and more effective in the long run for the courts to decide that claims are not meritorious and so state in written conclusions than to try to administer procedural doctrines to save judicial time and effort, with the word save in quotation marks. Essentially what the commissioners determined after looking at this a great deal is that there may be more cases, but they are going to be much less procedurally complex. They are going to be able to be dealt with much easier and more directly if we deal with them on the merits. Also, although it is not really a legal argument, it is more of a perspective argument as someone from someone who has represented criminal defendants for the last almost 20 years. Most of the people that I speak with as clients or as prospective clients, when something is denied on a procedural ground, that one, they don't understand the procedures. They understand the merits. They see a case. They say, my case is like that case. They don't understand the procedures. And when they are denied on the procedures, this only adds to the frustration. They're already in prison. They're going to be frustrated by being in prison. We can't change that. That's one of the reasons they're in prison, for punishment. But if we unnecessarily add to the frustration by saying we're not even going to look at the merits of your case because you didn't follow these procedures, that only adds to the frustration. I think it adds to the successive petitions. Maybe I just didn't explain it to them right. They just didn't understand. If I get a different judge, then maybe they will understand it.
Or a different lawyer.
Or a different lawyer, if they have a lawyer. Most of them aren't going to have lawyers. The vast majority of the 97406 petitions, I believe, are filed by non-lawyers just because they don't have the money. They're in prison. They aren't going to have access to that. And I think if their issues are actually decided on the merits and not having them view the court as sidestepping or trying to evade the merits, because if you evade the merits, what they are going to think is, I would have won if they just hadn't cheated me, if they hadn't done this procedural sidestep to get around my merits. I am right, and the court has not told me that I'm not right yet. If the court will just address the issues on the merits, then I think that we will save a lot of, it may be naive, but I think that they will feel respected more.
Well, there are a lot of merits, and so you can bring them up all at once, one at a time, two at a time. In other words, if I hear this, and I'm just asking myself, mm-hmm. because we have lived with Escalona for 9 years, and I have been on this court at least that long, and up until we had this case, and we read Judge Deiniger's concern about this, it seemed to me, at least from from what I heard in the field and having people like yourself appear here several times to talk to us about these cases, that my question would be, if you have six issues, maybe four of them are real good, maybe two are real good, but if we change this, then you can bring them up one at a time if you want.
And
no. You can't?
No.
Tell me why.
Okay. Well, you can bring them up on either direct appeal or the first appeal or the first collateral review, yes. You can do that. You cannot bring it up on a second or third or fourth 97406 petition.
Not the same issues, but I'm talking
no,
about...
No, even different issues.
Okay.
Because all we are arguing is that the provisions of 97406 sub 4 do not apply, the omitting an issue does not apply on the first 97406 petition after a direct appeal. Because the reference in that statute is to all grounds for relief must be raised in the defendant's original supplemental or amended motion. What my argument is that motion that they were referring to is a 97406 motion. That's the way it was construed in Bergenthal. And
you're asking for a return to Bergenthal.
That's basically what, yes.
Yes.
And that gives you one direct appeal and one 97046.
Yes,
period.
Absence.
Unless something is very special.
Right.
All right. Well, I have on my petition to review forms since Escalona have marked, except for the last maybe half a year, all the cases that involved Escalona, of which there are many each time. But they're rather simple. The memorandum says there's been one direct appeal, or it says there's been one 97406. This could have been brought up. It wasn't. He's out. So for our court, Escalona, from what I see, has caused no difficulty at all. In fact, they're rather simple petitions for review because I know what the answer is going to be as soon as I pick it up. And we've had very few that have any special reason because I think there are very few special reasons. So how do you explain that there's such a difficulty when we don't see it? Or at least I haven't seen it, and you'd think I would be sensitive to it and watch for it. That's why I marked the Escalona, because I predicted a problem. But there have been very few special reasons, so it's an automatic deny.
Well, one of the issues there is how to define special reason, and that is one issue that I think at some point this Court is going to have to decide, at least on in the broad outlines of it. This is not a case presenting that exact issue. There is a case pending review, State v. William Thornton, that does present that issue, but it is being stayed pending decision on this case. And I'm sure that there are other decisions out there. But actually, when you...
State v. Thornton, right.
Yes.
Okay.
Which I'm sure is a totally gratuitous plug on my part since it's my case, but
okay, I got it in my file.
Yes.
It was held for
okay.
This.
Okay, but that does present the issue of sufficient reason, and I think one of the reasons why that is important is because the scope of the problem with Escalona and Aranha probably depends or is inversely proportional to how broadly you read sufficient reason. Again, the reasons or the comments to Section 8 of the Uniform Procedures, Post-Conviction Procedures Act say that it should be read broadly to provide a similarly permissive view of when you can have a successive petition. If we view it that broadly, if we view it as basically incorporating or incorporating the deliberate bypass rule, then I don't think that Escalona and Aranha really matters at all. Because under the deliberate bypass rule, If the defendant didn't make the decision not to raise an issue, he can raise it later, as long as he was not personally involved and intentionally waive the right to bring something in a prior court. He can raise it later. Obviously, the U.S. Supreme Court has now rejected that for purposes of federal habeas, but we're talking about a statute that was enacted at the time when the Supreme Court felt otherwise and incorporated the provisions and the views of the court at the time. So if you actually view sufficient reason as broadly as it was originally intended in Section 8 of the Uniform Act, I don't think actually Escalante and Arano causes any problem at all. But unfortunately, that issue is not really before the court right now. And what we have is current proceedings in which most individuals who allege sufficient reason are alleging ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel. It is a problem in the trial courts. It's a problem in the Court of Appeals. I don't know why the court isn't seeing it in petitions for review unless it is, again, pro se defendants who are raising these and do not have the wherewithal to present them adequately.
Mr. Hennig, I hate to be obtuse, but I don't quite understand this. Let me give you a hypothetical, and you explain exactly where you want to go. We have a criminal trial. There are 10 potential issues in that trial. 4 of them are raised on appeal and disposed of.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 6 left. There's a 97406 hearing. 4 more are raised. Okay. Now, okay. What do you want to do with those last 2 issues?
Unless the defendant has a sufficient reason for not raising them on either on the first 97406 petition, he's out of the water. If he does have a sufficient reason, however this court ultimately defines it, he can raise it in another 97406 petition.
And how is that different from Escalona?
Because in Escalona and Arano, you would not be able to raise the 4 issues in the first 97406 petition because they were technically available at the time of the direct appeal. And you would not be able to raise the 2 additional issues for the same reason. They were technically available at the time of the original appeal. So unless you have sufficient reason, however that's defined, you cannot raise that even in a first 97406 petition.
I don't want to be obtuse either, but I'm not quite sure I understand Deininger's onion problem. So tell us exactly what happened here and why it's the onion issue and what causes it to, for the Court of Appeals to get to the merits but then have to then again decide the merits, if I understand the issue at all. Okay?
Okay. When someone files 97406 petition under Escalona or a second petition, he has to allege sufficient reason. In this case, it was a first 97406 petition. The defendant, Mr. Lowe, alleged ineffectiveness of post-conviction and appellate counsel as his sufficient reason.
Post-conviction appellate counsel. Okay. Is that you're talking about direct appeal or you're talking about the first 97406?
No, that would only be on the direct appeal. The okay. Courts have not recognized a right to counsel, constitutional right to counsel on a 97406 petition, so this wouldn't be a problem because there would be no ineffectiveness in that petition.
All right.
Defendant files the 97406, alleges under Escalante and Arano, he has to allege sufficient reason. His sufficient reason is ineffectiveness of post-conviction or appellate counsel. Before getting fully to the merits, the court, circuit court in that case, or the Court of Appeals on an appeal, has to decide whether, in fact, on the facts of this case, there is sufficient reason for not having raised these issues earlier. Now, in Mr. Lowe's case, there are actually issues that the court found were decided previously. I think that's what Kowski says, those have to be dismissed. He didn't allege any sufficient reason covering those. So those are just set aside. The issues that were not raised on direct appeal and that the defendant said should have been raised and an effective attorney would have raised, the court then has to determine applying the standards in Strickland and Smith v. Robbins, whether, in fact, there was an effectiveness of counsel. To address those or to assess that, the Court has to look first at deficient performance and then at prejudice. Deficient performance under Smith is whether the issues that the defendant says should have been raised are clearly stronger than the issues that, in fact, were raised. The Supreme Court in Smith adopted the Seventh Circuit decision in Gray, both of which are cited in the briefs and I think also in the Court of Appeals decision. In assessing whether an issue is clearly stronger than those that were raised on direct appeal, the Court has to assess the merits of both issues. If you get beyond that, then you have to assess prejudice. Prejudice, again, is whether there is a reasonable probability of a different result under Strickland. The Supreme Court in Smith applied the same standard to effectiveness of appellate counsel. The Court has to, therefore, decide whether there is a reasonable probability that the defendant would have won on the issues that he identifies that were omitted from the direct appeal. Again, we have to look at the merits of those.
Is that always true in this context? When a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel is raised in the context of a Knight or Rothering ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel claim, does the Court always have to get to the merits of the underlying ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim? Or can't it just go directly to the prejudice issue, apply legal rules pertaining to standards of review, sufficiency of evidence, deference, high burden in reviewing a jury's verdict beyond a reasonable doubt, et cetera, and dispose of it in a rather more summary fashion?
When there is the underlying claim is ineffectiveness of trial counsel, you can resolve the claim by looking at whether there, in fact, was ineffectiveness of trial counsel, applying the Strickland standard to that. But what you are doing in that case is addressing the merits.
Well, no, you're applying the Strickland standard to post-conviction appellate counsel's conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves a determination, at least as to the prejudice prong, whether or not the result on appeal would have been different. And that involves the application of different legal standards.
Right.
That are highly deferential to the verdict.
Yes.
Right?
And what you are assessing in that case is the merits of the underlying issue, the underlying substantive claim.
But you're doing it in a very summary fashion as opposed to an initial ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, had it been brought properly.
I wouldn't say it's summary. I'd say that you're essentially addressing the merits and deciding it on the merits, which is exactly what I'm asking the Court to direct on a first 974-06. You're not applying any lesser standard to the ineffectiveness of trial counsel claim in that case than you would if you were addressing it directly on the merits of that claim.
And you want here 974-06 opened up beyond just ineffective assistance of post-conviction appellate counsel claims. You want it reinterpreted. You want Escalona gone. You want 974-06 reinterpreted to allow one shot at collateral review under 974-06, no matter what.
Right. Yes. And I see my time is gone. So.
You get right to the merits instead of fooling around with ineffective assistance, which ultimately has to leave it on the merits anyway.
Exactly.
That's your point.
Yes.
Which may or may not be right.
I may or may not lose, or may or may not win on the substantive issue, but at least we get a decision on it.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wellman?
Bring this down a little. May it please the Court, Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General representing the State in this case. Let's start out, if we would please, by recognizing that we're not here, you're not here, the Court is not here to decide an interpretation of 974-06 sub 4 in the first instance. You did that, and we believe you did it correctly in Escalona. So the only question is, whether you should now overrule Escalona.
But of course, Escalona was the second time we dealt with it. We did it first in Bergenthal.
Right.
So this is the third time.
Right.
Okay. Maybe third time's a charm.
Right, so we said one thing in Bergenthal. We overruled it in Escalona, and now we're asked to look at two cases.
Right. Although in Bergenthal, the court really did not do a statutory construction analysis. It relied primarily on Loop, which was distinguishable because in Loop, the defendant had not had a direct appeal at all.
That's what the court said in Escalona.
Right, right. And I think, you know, if we want to look, well, I just want to make one point about the interpretation of Escalona being correct, and that is that in 974-06-4, Wisconsin did not wholly adopt Sanders and Fay, because Sanders held that ordinarily the federal court should allow a prisoner to bring successive collateral petitions. We do not allow that under 974-06-4. Even under Mr. Lowe's view, you get one direct appeal with counsel, constitutional right to counsel, and one 974-06 to do whatever you want. But you don't get successive 974-06. So we didn't go that far. And Fay involved a state prisoner who had not had a direct appeal. His counsel had missed the deadline. So you did not have, although you have the language that counsel relies on, you did not have the fact situation that we have here, where you have a defendant who had a direct appeal with counsel and now wants to bring a 974-06 and raise different additional issues. And I can't, there is nothing in the language or the purpose of 974-06 that makes me think, why would the legislature intentionally want to create a system where you allow a litigant two chances to bring issues on appeal that he could have brought in one chance, at one time, close to conviction, when the record is clear, memories are fresh. If he is being unconstitutionally confined, he will get relief sooner rather than later. If the case does have to be retried, it will be retried sooner rather than later. It seems so clear that the reason and the need for 974-06 was obvious. There were issues you could not bring on direct appeal because you didn't have a record. You couldn't claim that your guilty plea was involuntary because your counsel had told you, you better plead guilty or they're going to take your children away or some such thing. You don't have a record in direct appeal. You needed something to make that record, to have that opportunity. 974-06 filled that gap. There's no gap to be filled when you could bring all those issues on direct appeal.
What about ineffective assistance of counsel because appellate counsel didn't raise the right issues?
If appellate counsel didn't raise the right issues, then as this court recognized in Knight, absolutely you have a remedy. That remedy is a Knight petition. We're suggesting a slight modification that you should bring 80930 post-conviction and appellate all in one petition before the Court of Appeals because it's all part of your direct appeal. Your remedy, then, is you get a new appeal with counsel. It's rather odd that in this situation, normally, if the state were arguing, well, if your direct appeal counsel was ineffective, you can bring this post-conviction motion, but you have to bring it pro se. I mean, normally the defense would be screaming. That's not a remedy for the denial of right to counsel.
But you have to do what you do the habeas in Knight with
right.
Pro se.
You could ask for counsel to be appointed, but ordinarily it would be pro se.
So either way, it's pro se.
Right, right.
So that's
but
not
the
a
direct
big deal.
But the difference is, if you do prove ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, you get the new appeal to litigate the underlying merits with counsel.
No, but you don't have counsel in a Knight.
No, ordinarily you don't.
Either way.
That part is pro se, but not the new appeal that you get. And our proposal is, let me back up. I think the problem here that we've seen develop after Escalona is not Escalona itself. Many times, many, many times, Escalona is extremely simple and straightforward. Defendant files a 974-06 motion after he's had a direct appeal already. He raises issues he didn't raise in direct appeal. He offers no reason whatsoever. It gets denied as it should with no hearing. Court of Appeals affirms, as it should, this Court denies petition for review. For those cases, nothing could be simpler. The complexity comes in because the Court of Appeals, I think, went off track by assuming that if you just allege that counsel was ineffective for not raising things on post-conviction or appeal, that's a sufficient reason to have a 974-06. And that's just wrong. It's not a reason to have a pro se collateral review. It's a sufficient reason to get a new appeal with counsel, if counsel was in fact ineffective.
But wasn't one of the underpinnings of that decision what seems to me to be simplicity? I look at this stuff and I say, I want it simple, and if I want it simple, I would guess that it should be simple for pro ses and other people also. And one of the underlying rationales for that was, look, it's a post-conviction, it's a 974-06. That happened in the trial court. Keep in the trial court what happens in the trial court. Keep in the Court of Appeals what happens in the Court of Appeals. The decision said Court of Appeals do oral arguments and briefs. I mean, it seems symmetrical to me.
Well, it's not awful, but it makes it very complicated because oftentimes, as Lowe did, he will raise both in the same petition. And here the Court of Appeals tried to split them out, and it said, well, we'll deal with the appellate issues, but not the 80930 post-conviction hearing positions. And if the whole issue is you have one direct appeal with the right to effective assistance of counsel, then it ought to be one court, the Court of Appeals, that's looking at that whole package.
I will say to that, I will say that maybe if the ineffective assistance of counsel happened in the trial court at the post-conviction motion, maybe the trial court who was there, who knows it, who was part of it, maybe that's where it should be handled. It just makes more sense to me. You may see it differently.
It may be six of one, half dozen of the other in terms of sort of how people logically see it. But what is critical here, and again, where with all due respect to the Court of Appeals majority, I think they went seriously astray, is they assumed that whichever procedure you use, whether you use 974-06 attack or a night petition, whatever procedure you use, they assumed we have to look at the merits, the underlying merits of the claim he's saying that either post-conviction circuit court counsel or Court of Appeals appellate counsel should have raised, because how else will we know if he's ineffective? And that is wrong.
What we're being asked to do here goes well beyond ineffective assistance of counsel claims, though, and would authorize a 974-06 motion for other sorts of claims that were not raised on the direct appeal.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. What Mr. Hannigan or Mr. Lowe is asking you to do is open the door to any and every claim on 974-06. It's open season on 974-06. You can raise 99 claims that you,
right.
If you want.
So a problem that exists in the context of one sort of claim for
right.
which there is an adequate remedy, a habeas petition,
right, right,
is now producing a request that has implications that go far beyond it.
Oh, I agree. And I think that's certainly a good reason why you should not overrule Escalona, because the vast majority of the time, Escalona works. It doesn't need to be fixed. It cuts those off at the very beginning.
Well, that was the probably a better question than I asked opposing counsel, but that was basically the question that I was going to ask you as I asked opposing counsel on the effect, because, and perhaps because, as the Chief Justice indicated, that we don't really see the effect, and she has kept track, and I have too, in the sense of knowing what effect it had on this Court, but it seemed to me that what opposing counsel is asking for would have a substantial effect and goes well beyond. This is what I was asking, and I wanted your comment on that.
Well, unfortunately, I can't give you any numbers because
well,
I don't know,
I don't,
but I think it will open the floodgates. I mean, I really think we will see a lot more 974-06s because there are at least some defendants, prisoners surely now, who understand, I can't do this. They don't let me do this, and they don't file one.
Would there be any reason that there would not? In other words, it does open up that area.
Right. There's no disincentive then. I can't imagine why there wouldn't be. And, of course, there's no time limit on 97406. So somebody who was convicted 20 years ago and never yet filed their first 97406 could file it.
We saw a huge increase in 97406 motions after Rothering in the circuit courts because it opened the door to precisely what we have here.
Right. And, you know, we cannot close that door completely because there is a constitutional right to counsel on direct appeal, and that includes the right to effective assistance of counsel. So we have to have a mechanism for that rare situation when appellate counsel really did provide constitutionally ineffective assistance. But we start with the presumption, first the presumption that trial court rendered effective assistance of counsel and made reasonable professional judgments, and secondly, the appellate counsel did. It's going to be rare that you overcome that, and the problem is, I think, in part, what Judge Zeininger was reacting to is because people see this as the only way to get out from under the Escalona bar, they just throw this out. And then, unfortunately, some of the appellate courts have reacted by saying, oh, well, gosh, we better look at the underlying merits of all the underlying claims. Well, you don't have to. If we look at Mr. Lowe's case, for example, one of the things that he complained about was his appellate counsel didn't challenge the prosecutor's closing argument, which he said was prejudicial for a variety of reasons. He called me a bad guy and referred to gangs, and he vouched for the victim's credibility, and there were several different problems he had with it. His trial counsel had not objected at closing argument, which is a waiver, and he hadn't moved for a mistrial. So he had waived that claim. He's saying his post-conviction or appellate counsel should have raised that claim. So to even get to that, you'd have to say, okay, his 80930 counsel, it was unreasonable for him not to raise this issue that had been waived below. It's going to be rare, if ever, that you can make that showing. And that's about all the appellate court is going to have to do, is say, if it was waived by failure to object below, how can it be unreasonable to not bring it up on appeal? Can you say no reasonable counsel would have failed to raise that issue? You have almost no you have no right to get review and almost no chance of review, much less reversal. And the same thing is true of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. We're not looking at the effectiveness of trial counsel in the first instance. We have to always keep in mind, what is the question? And the question on the Knight petitions that we're advocating should be used as a procedural mechanism, the question is, was the ineffective assistance of trial counsel so glaringly obvious that any reasonably competent attorney should have recognized it and raised it? And there's a reasonable probability that if he'd raised it, he would have won on appeal. And that is going to be a rare, rare bird. And it should be. Because by and large, whether defendants are frustrated at being in prison or not, by and large, the system works.
Counsel, one of the things that always rings in my ears and perhaps with the other justices is the discussion of the floodgates. You know, my God, no one wants floodgates. I mean, no one's a flood. Everyone wants good gates. Your opposing counsel indicates that, no, his position isn't opening up those floodgates, but rather the Bergenthal, which under Bergenthal, you had one direct appeal and one 97406, unless there was sufficient reason or special circumstance. But you're saying, no, your opposing counsel's position isn't what he's saying it is. Can you explain that?
I'm not sure I understood your question.
In response to an earlier question, I can't remember if it was billions and billions, but it was a multitude of opportunities to bring 97406 motions if you went along with your opposing counsel. That was your response to questions, as I understood your answer, in response to Justice Wilcox's concern. And I'm just saying that response portraying opposing counsel's position is inconsistent with the way that he's portraying it. He's saying just give me Bergenthal, as I understand it. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Just give me Bergenthal, one direct appeal, 1974-06, that's it, unless there's a special sufficient reason.
I agree with that. I think that is his position. What I thought I was saying, or what I meant to say, was I think we will see more of those first 974-06 motions if you overrule Escalona, because I think there are surely prisoners out there who have not done it.
Okay. That
they believe Escalona exists and they don't bring a petition.
It's not that an individual defendant is going to have a multitude of opportunities to bring 97.
No, he's going to have two cracks.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that we confused you. I also just want to point out, if I understood Mr. Hanna correctly, he said that the United States Supreme Court in Smith versus Robinson had adopted the Gray versus Greer case out of the Seventh Circuit. It didn't adopt it. It referred to it as an example. And one thing that Greer says is when you're doing this evaluation of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, one of the things that you look at, in addition to was there a lot of merit to this claim that wasn't raised, was, well, how did it compare in terms of weakness or strength to the issues that counsel did raise? And we don't have a problem with that per se, but I think we have to remember that the very essence of counsel's job, appellate counsel's job, is to sinnow and whiff. That didn't come out right. Sift and winnow.
I liked it the first
time. I liked the first one better.
I liked a little of that.
All of the claims that could potentially be brought on appeal. And there is no right to have counsel bring all of the issues. And so by definition, counsel is going to do some picking and choosing, and the courts shouldn't second guess that. If the defendant is saying, look, here was this really, really dynamite, sure winner, great issue, I would have won, he should have raised it, he ought to be obligated at least to also plead then and show, and it was better than all these others that he did raise.
With all due respect, Ms. Wellman, are you always sure what's the sure winner issue that you're going to win on here?
No, I'm not. And I'm sure appellate counsel for defendants aren't either.
And probably trial counsel either.
That's right.
I would be quite surprised. Howard Eisenberg once told me that he kept score of what he expected to win and what he didn't expect to win. And he was always very surprised at the end of the year about some that he won and others that he lost. So it's not so easy to make that decision. But by hindsight, it's somewhat easier. So I think it's difficult to tell whether trial counsel, instead of having the court, what was Bob Hansen's expression, be a dancing bear to every tune. You don't want them to raise every single issue, right?
Right.
You want them to understand waived is waived.
Right. Right.
Which makes an issue as to judgment calls and whether or not somebody should be sitting in prison on somebody else's judgment call.
Well,
how about the issue is?
You can look at it that way, but if you look at it that way, I think you have to go all the way back to Jones versus Barnes, which said you are bound by counsel's reasonable choices on appeal if you choose to have counsel.
That's right, reasonable choices, and somebody has to look that over.
Right, but only at the level of reasonableness. Was it unreasonable to fail to raise this? And if it was waived below, or if it was an evidentiary issue where the standard of review is going to be abuse of discretion, or if it was a fact issue, or a jury verdict issue where there's extreme deference to the fact finder, the chances that it was unreasonable for counsel to fail to raise that issue on appeal instead of some other issues are pretty slim. And I think what the defendants really want in this case, I don't hear anybody, the amicus or Mr. Lowe, saying, you know, there are a lot of claims that are not being brought on direct appeal that defendants would have won on. We're not hearing that. I don't think we're seeing that. What we're hearing is we just want defendants to be able to have two chances. One with counsel, give it your best shot, make your reasonable professional judgment. I'll trust you to do that. But then when I'm still sitting in prison and I don't like it, I'm frustrated and I just want to be able to raise all these other issues. And that's not the system the legislature created. And it's not a system I mean, the only downside, it seems to me, that really has been pointed out is if you get to the level of alleging ineffective assistance of post-conviction and appellate counsel, who is alleging, and the allegation is they should have raised ineffective assistance of trial counsel, you got some onion layers to get through. It's a little procedurally complex. But that's no reason to throw out the whole rule. And if you look at it at the level of the question is no longer was prosecutor's closing argument error? Was it prejudicial? Was it a denial of due process because he called the defendant a scummy person? That's not the question. The question is, when trial counsel didn't object and didn't make a motion for mistrial, should appellate counsel still have raised it and tried to show it was plain error, given the high standards for overturning a conviction? Or should he have raised ineffective assistance of trial counsel, given the high standards of proving that? Was it unreasonable for him not to raise that claim? No. And what's interesting here is, well, notice that Mr. Lowe in this court is no longer claiming, he's no longer arguing the merits of any of the issues he raised in his 974-06 motion. And even though we think the Court of Appeals wrongly went too far into the merits of those underlying claims, he's not claiming in this court the Court of Appeals should have granted him relief on any of those claims. And that is very, very telling, because that shows us that those claims and many of these claims, in fact, one of the amicus writers agreed, most claims will be meritless. And it's true. There may be some that are not. I'm not saying there is never a defendant who has been is unconstitutionally incarcerated. But the remedy for that is the direct remedy of did appellate counsel on direct review provide ineffective assistance of counsel and fail to raise a claim that would have gotten him released or a new trial? And if he did, then he gets relief. But not through this contorted mechanism of just, you know, you get one direct appeal, and then you get to clog the courts again by raising any other issues you want to raise.
Well, and the result of overruling Escalona in this context would also, it would not necessarily mean that these claims of ineffective assistance of post-conviction appellate counsel would now be confined to that first 974-06 petition. We may just as likely see a first 974-06 collateral review on a variety of other issues and then a successive Knight petition.
That's possible. And it may, in fact, have happened already. I'm not aware of whether it has or not. But
are you asking us to get rid of Rothering?
Yes, I am. I think that it's procedurally better and it focuses on the right issue to say if the issue was your direct appeal counsel ineffective? And we have this rather unique and I think very good system in Wisconsin where direct appeal means you can raise evidentiary issues. So you can challenge your guilty plea or you can challenge the ineffectiveness of or the effectiveness of trial counsel. And then you bring that and all of your true appeal issues that are contained in the record all at one time. So we have the whole record, the whole proceeding. We're looking at that all as one box, in one box. I think it's appropriate to do all that together. And I think if we apply the right standards to ineffective assistance and focus on was counsel ineffective for failing to raise this rather than immediately jumping to the underlying merits, it can be done pretty much on a paper review. Now, occasionally you might have a fact situation. You might have a defendant who says, I told my trial counsel that when I confessed the police were beating me up with rubber hoses and putting a hot lamp on me and wouldn't feed me. And he didn't raise that. He didn't challenge my confession. And then I told my post-conviction counsel that. And he didn't challenge that. And trial counsel would say, he never told me that. It's not in the police reports. There was no evidence to bring that. You might need to remand for an evidentiary hearing there if you've got, you know, facts that are opposing. You've got one witness saying one thing, one saying another. But that's going to be rare at this level.
Counsel, what does this do to the stare decisis argument that you make? Your stare decisis on Escalona is 1A, you know, right up there. You're right. And I sit there and thinking about this case and oftentimes have to deal with this issue. This Escalona was 1994. And there's a lot to be said about stare decisis and the integrity of a court. Happens to be that it overruled another case on the very same issue, but that happens. You know. Stare decisis is very important. But in leading with 1A, don't overrule stare Escalona, you are now someplace in the middle of your brief say, but by the way, let's overrule Rothering. I mean, so doesn't that undercut your 1A argument of the import of stare decisis to the institution of the court?
Well, I think we admit in our 1A argument that while it is preferable, and it certainly there should be a good reason to overrule it, it's not a hard and fast rule that you can never overrule. And while, since we're in the position in this case of looking afresh at Escalona, and has it worked out, and is it too complicated, and how has it played out in this last almost 10 years, I think it's appropriate to look at Rothering. And while I realize, you know, the Court of Appeals' published decision is precedent just the way this Court's is, the fact of the matter is Rothering was Court of Appeals, and they were trying to interpret what Escalona had not yet talked about, which is how do you deal with claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So I think there's more good reason to overrule Rothering. But even if you don't, even if you say, yes, you can continue to bring ineffective assistance of counsel as a sufficient reason under Escalona, we still have to put teeth and meaning back into what ineffective assistance of counsel really means. And the Court of Appeals didn't do that here, the majority.
Could you respond to the argument set forth in the amicus brief of the Remington Center? It's set forth on page 6, but I'll read it to you. It indicates that under the approach of the state, Mr. Brown, and I'm focusing on your Rothering argument, Mr. Brown would have to file a habeas in the Court of Appeals alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, appellate counsel. As with the current approach outlined above, the Court of Appeals would assign the case to a referee for an evidentiary hearing, after which the case would return to the appellate court for a ruling on the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. If the Court of Appeals found that appellate counsel was ineffective, the remedy for Mr. Brown would be a new appeal. But what would be the point? In order to find appellate counsel ineffective under Strickland, the Court of Appeals would have had to rule that there's a reasonable probability that Mr. Brown would be entitled to a new trial. Why not just order the new trial?
That's the part you want to answer. Well, I think because primarily we put that forth because that was a remedy that Knight held you get, and that was what was asked for in Knight. And ordinarily, if someone is saying, well, I was denied my right to effective assistance of counsel at this proceeding, you get that new proceeding. It may be, and I think also we just don't want to abolish the distinction between reasonable probability and for sure, because that, you know, could slide into putting a higher burden on a defendant, that you have to show you absolutely would win, because reasonable probability and winning are two different things. I think in some cases, if it's that clear, there's not going to be any point in having another appeal because the state would confess error. And I know at least the one federal court that the defense cites that found ineffective assistance of counsel is Mason versus Hanks. It's cited in Mr. Lowe's brief. And there they said, well, at the state's election, you get either a new appeal or a new trial. So in some cases, you could just get the ultimate relief. But I don't think that undercuts our whole position, that the way to bring these is in the appellate court in a Knight petition focused on what the defendant was deprived of, which was his constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel on appeal, not a right that he wishes he had to have an open season in which he can just bring a 974-06 motion and litigate whatever issues he wants for no reason at all.
How about a habeas petition starting in the trial court alleging ineffective assistance of post-conviction appellate counsel?
You could.
974-06, it's the habeas, but you start in the trial court, and if there's fact-finding necessary, the trial court orders it.
You could do that. I think in most cases you won't need fact-finding because it won't be a factual dispute, and so there's really no reason to start there, and those can be taken care of by the Court of Appeals authority of remand if they need fact-finding. But, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I mean, I think it's, either procedure would work and would still get us out from under the problem that the wrong interpretation of Escalona has created.
It solves the problem that's being raised in the amicus brief.
Right. It solves that problem. Right.
The remedy that's ordered is if there's relief to be granted.
Yeah, that's true. That would be simpler. That would be more streamlined. I also think that under Kimbrough and Kohler, which are cited in our brief, it's clear that the reasonableness or deficient performance part of an ineffective assistance of claim is an objective standard. So if you can tell from the record there's an objectively reasonable reason why counsel wouldn't have raised this, you don't have to have a hearing to ask him, did you not raise this because it was waived below? You don't need to do that. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Hennick, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
With regard to whether you could do a habeas, I would direct the Court's attention to 97406 sub 8, which specifically says that 97406 is to be a substitute for habeas, and we are not to come up with new ways of applying habeas petitions, as the State has suggested. 97406 is the remedy that the Court or that the legislature has enacted to address those issues, unless for some reason they cannot be.
You're not suggesting that there be no remedy for an ineffective assistance of post-conviction?
No, not at all. What I am suggesting is that Rothering is correct, and that when it is in the trial level, the circuit court on a 97406 petition is perfectly capable of handling it, and it's the appropriate court to handle it. Just as in this, in Knight, this court held that on when it's appellate counsel, something that happened in the Court of Appeals, then the Court of Appeals is proper to, is the appropriate court to handle it. I think one other thing that that seems to be some confusion, what I am talking about with the ineffectiveness of post-conviction and appellate counsel is not limited to a certain type of claim. Virtually every claim that has any chance or any merit that could be raised in a first 97406 petition could be based on the sufficient reason of ineffective assistance of counsel or ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel. Because a non-frivolous argument can be made in each of those cases that the omitted issue was stronger than the issues that were actually raised and lost. So this isn't limited to one kind of claim, and then we're going to have a lot of other kind of claims that are going to get a windfall benefit from returning 97406 up 4 to its original meaning. Escalon and Arano works if what you are trying to do is avoid decision on the merits. The people that are hurt by Escalon and Arano, other than the court system, which has the extra work of having to peel through these layers, is individuals who are in custody who, for some reason, have meritorious claims that were not raised on direct appeal and that cannot raise them on a first 97406 motion, either because they do not have the money for a lawyer or do not have the wherewithal to sail through the procedural hurdles. That's a very bad analogy, mixed metaphor, to get over the procedural hurdles that Escalon and Arano rose. Someone who has a lawyer knows that ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel is sufficient reason. That's what the courts consistently have said in this state. There is absolutely no support in the history of Section 8 of the Post-Conviction Procedures Act supporting the state's argument. In fact, putting everything into the Court of Appeals would seem to be directly contrary to the whole purpose of 97406, which is to get these things out of the appellate courts. Now, the state suggests that we aren't up here arguing that there are a lot of claims that were not brought because of Escalon and Arano. I submit, although I have no more direct personal knowledge than the state does on that, that there in fact are several that have not been brought or have not won because of Escalon and Arano. What we have is a procedural hurdle that pro se individuals do not have the ability to get over, not because they lack the facts or the law to do it, but they don't have the mental or emotional ability to do it. I've handled several cases in which individuals come to me after a direct appeal. The direct appeal did not raise issues that I believe are clearly stronger than those raised on direct appeal. I have raised several 974-06s based on ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel. There is one problem with current law that we have to do it in both a Knight petition and a 974-06. But we could get rid of all of that if we overrule Escalona. At that point, we can raise the issues on a first 974-06. During that 974-06, you do not have a right to the constitutional assistance of counsel. So on a second 974-06, you could not come back and say, well, my sufficient reason for not raising it on the first 974-06 is because my counsel on that was ineffective.
You could also get rid of most of that by keeping Escalona and revising the procedure, which is case law driven, not statute driven, on how you litigate a claim for ineffective assistance of post-conviction appellate counsel, and say that you do it in a habeas, because habeas is always still available, because you've got to have a remedy, but you start in the circuit court and then proceed up from there.
You possibly could do that, but I don't see any reason why that would be more efficient than a 974-06 petition, especially since...
Because it doesn't open the door to all these other sorts of claims that overruling Escalona would, and it solves the problem that was created by the Knight-Rothering dichotomy. It sounds very grand. I don't think it is, but...
But again, you're not opening it to all these other claims, because all these other claims, if they are properly pled in the first 974-06 motion, the vast majority would be ineffective assistance claims, ineffective assistance of post-conviction and appellate counsel.
What's the matter with substituting habeas? Instead of 974-06, call it a habeas in trial court. What difference does it make to you?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, the legislature has said that 974-06 is a process.
Well, we've already dealt with that. Forget that. Let's go on to the next one.
Okay. Why it would be, as long as there is some way to raise these things.
Well, habeas has more limited issues that you can raise than under a 974-06, if I remember all this right. But we're really talking about ineffective assistance of counsel here,
right,
which is a constitutional doctrine. Mm-hmm. And so habeas goes to constitutional issues. 974-06 does too. So, I mean, if the court would want to label a 974-06 habeas, what difference does it make to you?
As long as the standards are the same and we're able to raise the same issues, it doesn't matter what label it is.
How do you get around 974-06-8? A petition for writ of habeas corpus shall not be entertained if it appears that the applicant has failed to apply for relief by motion to the court, which, in other words, as I understand, the legislature in 974-06-8 is saying something very contrary to what the chief is suggesting. You know, one's the same as the other. I think 974-06-8, my reading of it, is take issue with that.
I would stick with 974-06-8, and one of the, I think my discussion with the chief was, you know, assuming that if I could have my choice, if 974-06-8 wasn't here, if I could rewrite this, what would I do? And I'm not here to rewrite it, obviously. The court isn't here to rewrite it. I'd ask that the court overrule Escalon and Arano, and on the substance of the issue, which we never really got, the substance for reversal, ask that the court reverse and grant Mr. Lowe a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments this afternoon on issues we have heard before. That concludes our hearing on 01-0843 State versus Anna Lowe. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.